Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we focus on reports from the ground on the systematic dismantling and destruction of Gaza, which has become a genocide. Al-Shifa's hospital's total destruction reveals Israel's intent to destroy not only the Palestinian people, but also their homes, infrastructure, and institutions that are the cultural glue of a civilized society. Al-Shifa was not just a hospital, but a vital medical compound that was at the heart of the entire Gazan medical structure. At the compound's center, there was a large open area that thousands of displaced Gazans had hoped would be a safe haven for their living to avoid the massive bombing by the Israeli military that destroyed their homes. This morning you will hear a portion of a Mondo Weiss podcast that discusses the implications of this massive destruction of this crucial medical facility with Mondo Weiss staff writers. The podcast begins with introductions.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. Joining me today are Faris Jacquemin and Qasem Mwadi, our new staff writer based in Ramallah. We are now past 180 days into this brutal genocidal war on Gaza, and it feels like events there and across the region are accelerating over the past couple of weeks. I wanted to have both of you on the podcast to talk about some of the key events and narratives you've been following. Let's start with Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza. Faris, can you give us some background on Al-Shifa Hospital? What is it, and what does it mean for Palestinians in Gaza?
Sure. Well, briefly, Al-Shifa Hospital is the largest hospital in Palestine, the largest Palestinian hospital. And it is essentially the nerve center of the health system in Gaza. So in previous wars, it has served as a very important hub for anything from, you know, the health system itself, to refugees who are coming in fleeing the bombardment, to, you know, police forces and civil defense teams to coordinate dispatching rescue efforts, all of that. And what this has essentially meant is that these kinds of hospitals, and Al-Shifa most of all, have become a kind of a pivotal sort of social institution, in a sense, especially during wartime. And Al-Shifa was kind of the key in the early days of the Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza. It was kind of the key to securing the ethnic cleansing of the north. The estimation of the Israelis was that if we're able to cause the fall of Al-Shifa, then it'll be able to successfully empty out northern Gaza because no one will have anywhere left to go to. So this is the context in which we should be looking at the invasion of Al-Shifa now and its subsequent destruction, which occurred just a few days ago.
Faris, can you describe the actual hospital itself? That's one thing that has come up with reader feedback, not understanding how so many people can fit into a hospital.
Right. Well, so the hospital isn't just one building. It's a very large medical complex composed of many different buildings with a large central courtyard. And it has the capacity, its grounds have the capacity to house many, many people. And before the latest invasion and destruction of Al-Shifa, it was estimated to house around 30,000 displaced people from the north of Gaza. So it's essentially a very large medical complex that has become a hub for displaced people and served as a microcosm of Palestinian civil society. So it's kind of been essential for the maintenance of the presence of the Palestinian population in northern Gaza.
Qasem, can you explain what happened there over the past few weeks?
Sure. So what happened in the past 2 weeks, it's important to remember that it's the second raid to Al-Shifa, because Israeli forces raided Al-Shifa back in November and forcibly evacuated it. At the time, we're hearing all these claims by the Israeli government and the Israeli army that there's somehow a military base for the Palestinian resistance underneath Al-Shifa that was never found. And then the Israeli forces force everybody to leave Al-Shifa and leave behind the newborn, prematurely born babies without incubators. What happened next is that as soon as the Israeli forces began to withdraw from Gaza City, from the surroundings of Al-Shifa, Palestinians went back to Al-Shifa and began to use it again, both as a hospital and as a refuge. At the time, journalists reported finding those babies basically decomposing. What happened is that return gave a signal that Israel's campaign, at least the impression that it gave, is that Israel's efforts to stop all forms of life in Gaza City and in the north weren't quite successful, because as soon as it withdrew, Palestinians were back and trying to get life back on the track. So this might explain, in a sense, why Israel raided Al-Shifa a second time on March 18th. And for 2 weeks, what the Israeli army did in Al-Shifa was basically systematically destroy the equipment and the infrastructure and the facilities. From the accounts and the testimonies of the medical staff and residents, in the past 2 days after the withdrawal, entire floors were set on fire. The equipment was intentionally broken and damaged. Al-Shifa had 750 rooms, 32 ICUs, 26 surgery operation rooms. All of them were destroyed. Dozens of rooms were destroyed. The equipment was completely destroyed, damaged. Entire floors set on fire, as I said. And also the most appalling thing is the dead bodies that were found. Testimonies have it that many bodies were found hands tied or hands cuffed and shot, not only in Al-Shifa, but in the surroundings of Al-Shifa. Up until this morning, the reports coming of recovering even more bodies. The first account spoke about 500 bodies, people killed, then 200. The Israeli army, from the beginning, said that they killed 200 terrorists. But we know from the accounts that many of those killed were medical staff, nurses, journalists, just residents in the surroundings of Al-Shifa. And in the words of the World Health Organization spokesperson, just yesterday, the Al-Shifa complex will not serve as a hospital in any form after today. So the Al-Shifa hospital basically doesn't exist anymore. That's what Israel actually did in Al-Shifa. It destroyed the largest medical facility in all of the Palestinian territories.
Do we know how many people were sheltering there when this second raid began?
We didn't have an exact figure, but there were in the thousands.
The last number that I saw was that it was estimated that almost 30,000 were housing there.
Yeah.
It's obviously not easy to make a definitive estimation, but it's probably in the order of tens of thousands of people.
So this raises the question of why Israel would focus so much military power on Al-Shifa. You both mentioned that a little bit. and other hospitals. Faris, you wrote a piece the other day arguing that Israel has been attacking hospitals to bring about a collapse of civil society. I want to read a little bit from your article, and we'll link to it in the show notes. Mm-hmm. You wrote, "Hospitals in Gaza during times of war have not only served as places for the treatment of the wounded and the sick, but have become pivotal social institutions, housing a microcosm of Gaza's entire civic order. They became hubs for journalists and human rights defenders, offered space for Gaza's civil defense teams to organize and coordinate rescue efforts, became a base of operations for Gaza's police force, and hosted tens of thousands of displaced refugees seeking shelter from the bombardment. Hospitals became all those things because they were the last remaining civilian institutions that were supposed to enjoy a modicum of protection from the war. In other words, they housed all the trappings of what makes a society function. In lieu of dismantling Gaza's resistance infrastructure, a goal that remains elusive for the Israeli army, one of Israel's war aims in Gaza has been to engineer social collapse. So why is Israel trying to engineer social collapse in Gaza?"
Well, the short answer is because social collapse will facilitate the thinning out of the population of northern Gaza to facilitate the ethnic cleansing of northern Gaza, which would be consistent with Israel's stated aims of bifurcating Gaza between the north and the south and having the north as empty as possible of people. And this is actually one of the key sticking points in the negotiations over a hostage swap. The sticking point being that the Hamas negotiating team is insisting that people be allowed back into the north, and Israel doesn't want that, and it's suggested as one of its counters to allow for only the women and children to go into the north after having passed some sort of security check. So this Israeli insistence just on that point in the negotiations shows very clearly that Israel isn't interested in allowing people to go back to their homes in northern Gaza, and it would like to maintain some form of permanent military presence, at least in the north, if not in all of Gaza. And it seeks to do so also by rendering northern Gaza uninhabitable, and Al-Shifa has been a very important component of that. Now, just to go back a sec, I wanted to maybe give a little bit of background on how we were sort of led up to this goal that Israel had. So first of all, on March 17th and March 18th, two events sort of happened in concomitance to one another that I think, even though they didn't necessarily appear to be related, are actually very integral to one another. First of all, on March 17th, you had a miraculous arrival of 13 aid trucks to northern Gaza. It had been the first time in months that trucks had actually arrived in the north, because in previous times, whenever they would have reached the Nablusi or Kuwaiti roundabouts, which were the areas that usually the trucks go through in order to arrive into the north and pass the Israeli checkpoint, there people would swarm the trucks, and then the Israeli army would shoot on the crowds, and it would lead to massacres of hundreds of people, one of the most infamous being the Flower Massacre on February the 29th, I believe. Right. And so on March 17th, what happened is that there was an arrival of all of these aid trucks in Jabalia refugee camp without incident. And the background to that is that in the days before, there were these pamphlets that were being distributed across of all of northern Gaza, basically signed by the Palestinian security forces, saying that or instructing everyone not to go to the Nablusi or Kuwaiti roundabouts because there was a shipment arriving, and for them to rather wait for the relevant authorities to tell them where, what gathering points to go to. And the remarkable thing is that everyone abided by that. And so they arrived in an orderly fashion. And then the actual distribution in Jabalia refugee camp was also done in an orderly way. People were waiting in lines, and they were also having their different rations recorded into a system according to their ID cards. So these were kind of the typical trappings of the sort of the bureaucracy of the Hamas government, the civilian arm of the government. So obviously for Israel, it is unacceptable to have any form of civic order because the government is Hamas, and it doesn't care if they happen to all be civilians, and if they happen to be in the civilian wing of the government, they're basically just clerks. For them, that is unacceptable because it means that Hamas has been able to consolidate or to sort of restore a certain degree of social organization and cohesion in the north, and Israel couldn't have that. The very next day, it launched the invasion of Al-Shifa on March 18th. And on that first day of the invasion, it assassinated the head of operations of the Gaza police force, Faye El-Mabhouh. He was assassinated along with a few dozen other people in Al-Shifa. And the assassination of Al-Mabhouh comes in the context of Mabhouh being one of the key central figures who organized the convoy to arrive in Al-Shifa the day before. Now, Faye El-Mabhouh was not a military person. He was in the police force. He was part of the civilian government. Of course, the Israeli claims were that he was a top Hamas commander. And the entire propaganda claim of the Israeli army has been that there is a renewed military presence of Hamas in Al-Shifa. Of course, without providing any evidence. The only quote-unquote evidence we've seen is of pictures of weapons that they filmed inside of the hospital. Of course, how those weapons got there, we have no idea. But it's literally not offered a single shred of evidence other than that footage.
And this is the second, this is at least the second time that they've aired footage of weapons in a hospital. Also the second time the weapons have been stored in an MRI room.
Yeah, which is probably not the best place to store a bunch of guns. And the Al-Shifa, the first invasion back in November has kind of been, it's become mostly recognized that the claims of a command and control center were completely untrue and was just an Israeli lie. And even the other claims of, well, they were hiding some weapons or whatever, or that there was military activity being conducted from within Al-Shifa, they found no evidence of that as well. They also found no evidence that whatever tunnels were may have been under Al-Shifa, there was no evidence that those tunnels could be accessed from within the hospital. So really, that kind of connection has been tenuous at best, if not a complete fabrication of Israel. The true reason is that Israel wants to cause a breakdown of Al-Shifa. It wants to cause an emptying out of Al-Shifa because, as I said, it's a key social hub. And it's also, you know, served as the headquarters for all of the civilian arms of the local administration of the government that keeps the society alive and functioning. So obviously this is part of its very systematic attempt of emptying out the north, starving out the north, and forcing people to move south. This has obviously been its plan from day one, and it's continuing with that. And that's also how we should understand the targeting of the World Central Kitchen convoy of aid workers, because the very next day after it killed those seven international volunteers, the WCK announced that it would be suspending its activities in Gaza. And ANERA also, you know, sent an announcement to the same effect. So the Israeli campaign is actually working.
Israeli claims about the north and about Gaza City have been contradictory. On the one hand, Israel has continuously repeated that Hamas still poses a danger in the north, and that the main reason why they don't want civilians back to their homes is that that might help Hamas continue to fight in the north. On the other hand, they also claim to have completed and ensuring operational control in the north, whatever that means. Now, what we have been seeing is that fighting in the north hasn't stopped. The operations by Palestinian groups, especially the armed wing of Hamas, haven't stopped a day from the tip north of the Gaza Strip to the tip south of the Gaza Strip. Like every 2 days or so, there's new footage coming out from these groups showing their fighters engaging Israeli troops in the north. Israeli soldiers haven't been able to go around on foot in Gaza City and ensure positions in Gaza City. They still move around in armored vehicles. So on the one hand, they say we have full command and control. On the other hand, they say, no, Hamas is still fighting. What we know for sure is that both claims are crisscross contradictory in terms of location. In al-Shifa itself, there was no fighting. In al-Shifa itself, reports keep coming up, only quoting Israeli army sources at face value, that there have been, that they killed this many terrorists, quote unquote, inside al-Shifa, and that there was fighting inside al-Shifa, trying to portray that the destruction of al-Shifa was a result of some kind of crossfire, when in reality there was no fighting inside al-Shifa. And even if there was one or two fighters, it doesn't explain the magnitude of the destruction. It doesn't explain setting entire floors on fire. On the other hand, what we have seen is that in the surroundings of al-Shifa, in the neighborhood surrounding al-Shifa, going from the Ashati refugee camp all the way to the central Gaza City, fighting has never stopped, even before the raids to al-Shifa. The Palestinian fighters have been engaging Israeli armored troops in the streets. So it's clear that the Israeli army hasn't been able to ensure control militarily in Gaza City and in the north. On the top of that, they can't allow civilian life to pick up again, because that would mean that months of campaigning, of genocidal campaign in Gaza, were for nothing, basically for nothing. And this shows that the real obstacle that Israel is trying to push against is not the armed force of Hamas and the Palestinian factions, but it's the resolve of the Palestinian society. That is basically what Israel is trying to break, not the few hundreds of guerrillas going around, you know, in flip-flops with RPGs. That's not exactly what Israel is fighting against. And that's exactly why Israel doesn't want people to go back to their homes, because they know the minute the war stops, from the rubble, people will pick up and start building from zero.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And just to add to what Qassam said, just as further illustration, as Qassam said, the fighting and the resistance in the north has been ongoing and hasn't really stopped at any point. And obviously, the resistance is you know, fighting from everywhere. But there has been not a shred of evidence shown that there were actual fighters from fighting from within the hospital. And, you know, it seems to me quite a coincidence that on the, you know, the very day after the aid was successfully coordinated for the first time in months by the Gaza civil government, that's when they decided to launch the invasion of al-Shifa and to assassinate the person who was in charge of that aid transfer. So obviously that's the real goal. The real goal is to try and rob Palestinian society of its ability to function and to exist.
Do we have any insight into how they were able to pull off that successful aid distribution, getting supplies from the south all the way into Jabalia?
Yeah,
and I mean, you said that they distributed flyers. I mean, Israel is running surveillance over the Gaza Strip constantly. How were they able to do that without Israel knowing about it?
Well, I mean, first of all, there it was done in a semi-clandestine way. So even the police escort wasn't dressed in police clothing, because there had been a systematic targeting of police accompanying aid convoys in the past. And actually, the Biden administration had asked Israel to stop targeting the Hamas-run police that was accompanying that aid convoy. So obviously, you know, there was a new need to act in a clandestine matter, and that's why the convoy was of masked gunmen. Now, of course, that was used as justification by Israel to say, oh, look, those are Hamas militants. But no, they were part of the Palestinian police force. Now, and how they were able to pull it off, you know, I mean, Israel has a multifaceted and multi-layered sort of intelligence system. There's human intelligence, there's surveillance, there's drone surveillance, etc. But, you know, equally so, the Palestinians have been able to, in some cases, circumvent this. And, you know, Gaza is a very complex terrain and it's a densely populated area. And, you know, they were able to pull it off. And I should also add that Faiq al-Mabhuh had coordinated this with a network of, first of all, international aid organizations and with UNRWA. And he'd coordinated this with what were called local committees or local tribes, tribal committees, that were also in charge of the distribution of this aid. Now, also an important context of this is that these tribes are Hamas's the Hamas government's attempts to sort of preempt Israel's attempt to set up the clans and tribes of Gaza as an alternative rule. So they're kind of co-opting that and trying using that in a way that's actually productive for maintaining Palestinian presence in the north. And then those committees, those tribal and popular committees themselves, were also targeted. And only a few days ago, they announced that they're going to stop their operations of delivering aid to the north as well, because 70 of their members have been killed by Israel on these aid operations.
If you look at the, for example, the World Central Kitchen, whose team was targeted and massacred in Deir el-Balah, I mean, they were getting food into the Gaza Strip through the maritime route, so through you know, via the sea. The Palestinian demand has been from the beginning to just open the land crossings, which is the normal route, the normal way to do it, and deliver food as it has been done historically through the UNRWA and through other organisms linked to the to Gaza's government. What Israel was trying to do is, through the maritime route, allowing some food, yeah, tons of food, but a drop in the ocean of the need in Gaza, through the sea, and the distribution being taken care of by NGOs like the World Central Kitchen, is in some way an attempt to use the need created by the siege to replace UNRWA and to replace the government bodies. Now, what Faris just explained, how the Hamas people, for example, like Faiq al-Mabhuh, managed to use all what is at their disposal, including the work of these NGOs, to pull off a distribution, orderly distribution of food, and hence reinforcing their presence in the northern Gaza Strip, might have sent a signal to Israel that this is not working. If anything, is just helping, you know, Hamas just restore order in the north in a different way. And it seems that replacing the UNRWA, even though it's one of the goals, while destroying the social order in the north and continuing to starve the people in Gaza, was a higher goal, which is why, you know, that can explain the strike on the WCK team, you know, early this week.
And just as a point of information, there are some rumors that the reason that the Israeli intelligence was able to get at Faiq al-Mabhuh is through his meetings with some of these international aid organizations, that perhaps there were people in those aid organizations that were in some way, you know, tied to the Israeli intelligence, or whether there was some sort of intelligence leak from those coordination meetings. And this is something that Haaretz itself has sort of conjectured about. And it said that this may be why the Israeli army very hastily launched the invasion of Al-Shifa only a day after the delivery of the aid. So it might be, so you're saying, how did that intelligence leak eventually happen? How they were able to get, it might have been through the coordination also with some of the aid organizations as well. I mean, we don't have a confirmation, but, you know, it could be true.
No, and even if they don't have, even if they're not sending that kind of information back to the Israelis, they're I mean, it's well understood that they're all the NGOs are coordinating their movements with the Israelis. Right. So if they're going to go to a meeting, they're going to tell the Israelis, we're sending our people to this meeting. Don't blow it up.
Yeah.
And they could, I'm assuming the Israelis could just very easily, you know, track people leaving the meeting.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. They're obviously very heavily surveilled. Yeah.
Yeah. So this starts to come to lead us back to this discussion of what happens the day after, if we're talking about the collapse of civil society in Gaza. And I want to note that this day after construct is a colonialist framework. I really hate it. But I'm curious if either of you have another way of approaching this discussion of what happens after this mass Israeli violence ends.
The day after is... Well, it presumes many things, that the war will end in a certain way, and therefore, you know, right. All the discussions about the day after involve mainly who will take care of the Gaza Strip. This, in some sort, you know, it takes into as a predetermined outcome that Israel will be able to dismantle Hamas in some way. Something to take into consideration when we speak about the aftermath of the war is that Hamas is not like a group of people with guns. Hamas is an integral part of Palestinian society and social fabric. It's everywhere. It's in education. It's in charity. It's in business. It's everywhere. And whatever you do to Gaza, at some point, if there is a society left in Gaza, and it will begin to heal and to reconstruct itself at some point, it will involve Hamas. Yeah, there's no two ways about it. Whether Hamas is in power, quote unquote, because what power can you have when you're under occupation? But if Hamas is running things in Gaza or not, is irrelevant to the question. And I think that Hamas, you know, even before October the 7th, were already looking for a way to get out of this responsibility, having to run Gaza. Without having to give away, you know, their weapons, basically. But what will happen? I think that the main thing here is what will happen to the Palestinian society and social fabric. We have seen that this Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, have shown a resolve that was not predicted by anyone. It's such a force of resistance on the not like resistance, like military fighting. I mean, on keeping themselves together as a community, being able to continue to run medical operations with the entire health sector crumble to the ground, to scratch. Being able to continuously, I mean, the Gaza municipality, at the same time that people went back to El Shifa, the employees of the municipality, no funds, no resources, nothing. They went back, they opened the municipality, and they began to assess the damage done to the city. So up to this point, Israel hasn't been able to break that. So whatever the political outcome of this will be, it will involve some recognition that the Palestinian society in Gaza has not been broken. And that will mean that Israel will need to acknowledge at some point in the future that this policy of genocide has proven to fail and to have failed. And this needs to have some political implications on the international level. We need to move to some sort of different paradigm to solve the entire conflict, because the repercussions of this war aren't limited to Gaza. They're also, reflected on Lebanon, on Yemen, on Iraq, on Syria, on the entire region, and on the West Bank, of course. So I think there is no way out of this without comprehensively looking at the root causes of the conflict, and Israel just coming to a point where it just admits that it just cannot simply destroy the Palestinian people by bombs.
Yeah. I would just want to echo a lot of what Qassam has been saying, but also just to emphasize that I think the quote-unquote day-after scenario really hinges on what happens in two areas. First of all, the ability of the Palestinians of Gaza to remain in their homes, whether it's in northern Gaza or in Gaza as is. That's number one. And number two, the ability of the Palestinian armed resistance, whether it be Hamas or the other groups, to remain sort of functional and able to maintain its level of military vitality and to sort of engage in a long-term war of attrition with the Israeli army. Now, what Israel has been somewhat more successful in is to achieve gains on the front of, on the non-military front, the front of causing mass displacement of Palestinians from the north to the south, although it hasn't been successful in causing a complete ethnic cleansing, because right now the Egyptian border is holding. Whether that will continue to be the case is somewhat up in the air, but it does look like that the window for Israel to cause a total ethnic cleansing of Gaza may have hopefully been shut. But I don't want to say that and then to have a new sort of opening be opened in Israel's genocidal campaign, whether it be through some sort of regional development, or I'm not really sure what else might happen. But let us hope that does not come to pass. As for the military component, I feel from what I've been able to glean from the information that is available to us, I feel that Israel has had relatively less success in terms of dismantling of the military capabilities of the Palestinian resistance. Obviously, Israel has clearly killed a certain level of Palestinian fighters, but it is not apparent to me that the declared number of around 10,000 fighters, it is not apparent to me that that is anywhere near accurate, because and this is actually something that the testimony from Israeli soldiers and field commanders themselves are saying, where they say that it's astonishing the reports of the number of quote-unquote terrorists who are being killed. And I think the quote is that one of the field commanders or the reserve or one of the reservists has been saying that we all know that there aren't hundreds of Hamas fighters that are just running around and being killed. And so the official reported number of 10,000 Hamas militants killed is almost certainly a gross exaggeration. So, and what is apparent is that the ability of Hamas to move from the south to the north is also still intact. To an extent, and this is evidenced by the launching of rockets from the north in the past week. So this means that absent some sort of black swan event where there's some sort of total ethnic cleansing or a regional development, I do not foresee the Palestinian resistance going anywhere. I do not see its ability to wage a long-term war of attrition being damaged, unless there is some sort of invasion of what is called the Philadelphia Corridor, which is basically the strip of land that separates the Rafah border from Egypt, which it has been surmised that this is one of the smuggling routes of Hamas weapons and supply lines. This is according to the Israeli intelligence, which, as we know, is not necessarily accurate, and probably Hamas has other sort of ways of smuggling in weapons, or maybe it's doing to an extent a certain amount of local manufacturing. So the question of being able to long term sort of replace its depleted stockpiles, whether it's of light weaponry or rockets, this is an open question as to whether it will be able to do so. I do not think that the horizon for them is closing in by any stretch. And so in whatever day after scenario, Israel will have to contend to the continuation of resistance and to the continuation of the presence of the people on the land. Their hope is that they will be able to get some sort of collaborationist native sort of like administrators, and they mentioned, as I said, the tribes and the clans, but now there's also an internal war being waged against those clans, and there's even been some talk that one of the mukhtars of one of the well-known sort of families was assassinated by Hamas, even though the evidence for that is not entirely clear and it might not be true, but it is obviously evidence that there is some sort of internal deterrence against that from within Gazan society, and of course also from, you know, from the resistance and from Hamas as well. So I think that what we're looking at more most likely is a long-term war of attrition scenario, unless of course there's some sort of black swan event that changes everything.
Yeah, I just want to add on these two points that Faris just mentioned. First, military-wise, I mean, this is not the first time that Israel attempts to whip off the map of Gaza an attempt of military resistance. I mean, military Palestinian armed resistance. We can safely say that it was born in Gaza in the first years right after the Nakba. And there was a time in the mid-70s that the Israeli army radio used to say that the army ruled Gaza in the day, and that the Fidayeen, the Palestinian guerrillas, ruled Gaza in the night. And that attempt was largely destroyed by the Israeli army in the mid-70s up to the end of the 70s. At the time, the Muhammad Deif of that time was a guy called Muhammad al-Aswad. And he was killed. And
Givara Gaza.
Israel, Givara, the Givara of Gaza, they used to call him. And Ariel Sharon personally oversaw the operations of transferring thousands of people from Gaza to refugee camps in the West Bank to clear entire areas so that the Israel army can cross through the refugee camps and isolate them from each other. So it was that crowded, you can imagine. And then the resistance picked off in the 80s, and then it grew in the 90s, and then it became what we know today as being, you know, Hamas. And so we're talking from the early days of the even before the PLO until today. This is a war of attrition that has never stopped. That did not begin on the 7th of October. That will not end after the ceasefire is achieved. It just will continue. The intensity of it might change. We might not be seeing, you know, long-range or middle-range rockets. We just be back to pistols, but just a matter of time before it picks up again. So this is just to say that the main point is, as I said before, is the root causes of the conflict in Gaza particularly. I mean, the fact that 70 to 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees, this in and of itself is what the entire conflict is about. And I think that Israel's conscience has always been that this can only end if the Palestinians just give up and just forget, and the young forget, as Ben-Gurion hoped after the old die. This didn't happen. Or that, you know, at some point we just need to finish the job in 1948. If it doesn't work in this time, then I think that it necessarily needs to have political implications worldwide. To say, okay, it's time just to get on the table and just solve this conflict once and for all and address what hasn't been addressed. What are the Oslo Accords were postponed for the final stage of negotiations, basically the right of return, Jerusalem, the Palestinian statehood. And if I might say, because what Faris said is also very, very important, we can speak about the day after, ruling out entire potential scenarios. This can end tonight. It could drag for a couple of months, from now, and end also with the ceasefire. But it can also blow into full-fledged war regionally in the entire Middle East. I mean, the front with Lebanon is heating up. The front with Iran is heating up. And we don't know what might happen. So I think that on this level, it doesn't only depend on the internal factors, I mean, on Israelis and Palestinians. Israelis and Palestinians and Lebanese and everybody involved in the region can do as much. I think it depends largely on the international community, on the world, on how much pressure, because I think that Israel at some point is testing how far can it go. And it's upon the rest of the world to show Israel that, you know, it went so far, it can't go, you know, any further. And it largely depends on that, you know, how this will end.
Kassam, you've been reporting on an incident that has not received much attention, but it may also point to what we're talking about here, the horizon for Gaza. The Interior Ministry in Gaza announced they arrested 10 intelligence officers from the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Can you tell us what happened here?
Well, we don't really know what happened because this was first reported by Hamas sources, first by the Interior Ministry in Gaza, and later by Hamas itself. And basically what they said was that a small force of up to 10 men belonging to the General Intelligence branch of the Palestinian Authority under the personal and direct direction of Majid Faraj. So Majid Faraj is the top official, and he's the head of the General Intelligence of the PA based in Ramallah, and one of the two strong candidates to succeed Mahmoud Abbas, that he personally oversaw this sending up to 10 men through trucks with belonging to the Egyptian Red Crescent, taking aid into Gaza, and that they had a secret mission. At first, they said that mission was to install chaos in the Gaza Strip, some kind of fifth column. Today, there were a little bit more details that they came out from Hamas, and they said that they had to. Basically, their mission was to contact local tribal contacts to try and establish a sort of network of people who would work together with the PA in coordination with Israel to just, take things from the hands of Hamas in a sense. And, that was not coordinated with Hamas. That was not coordinated with anyone. It was coordinated with the Israeli army. It was completely secretive. Hamas even said that the Egyptians told them that they had no knowledge about this. So it's clearly, from the perspective of Hamas, a hostile action. So they arrested them. Now, the Palestinian Authority first just denied everything. And they said that, Hamas are just being delusional. They're just saying whatever because they just want to cover up the mess that they've created in Gaza and so on and so forth. Majid Faraj himself didn't speak on the subject, but it's curious to note that 3 or 4 days before this announcement came out from Hamas, Yoav Gallant himself, the war minister of Israel, was saying that, yeah, there are attempts to coordinate, that the U.S. is trying to coordinate something with Faraj, not with the PA, with Majid Faraj personally, to try and create some sort of alternative to Hamas in the quote-unquote day after. So it's just curious how things just came like so successively, So up to this point, we don't know. But I think that something important to note is that in the Palestinian public opinion, there is absolutely no one who came out like, no, this is just impossible. They would never do it, On the contrary, everyone was, they could do that. I mean, Majid Faraj could do something like that. I mean, just the fact that this could potentially be true and that Palestinians, take it as a real possibility. They would expect Majid Faraj to do something like that, the PA to do something like that, speaks a lot, says a lot about how internal politics, Palestinian internal politics are working. I just, and what state are they are, they're on. I just like to indicate something that is happening right now, is that the PA just appointed a new government for the West Bank. Supposedly, the same ministers are supposed to run things in Gaza, theoretically. But things in Gaza, I mean like the health minister is supposed to, theoretically, to be the same health minister. There's one minister that is in Ramallah. But on the ground, there's separate bodies, and the one in Gaza is run by Hamas. So there's this new government. And as soon as this new government was announced, before even the names were put out, a coalition of Palestinian factions, including Hamas, including the Islamic Jihad, including other secular, non-armed Palestinian factions like the Palestinian National Initiative and the People's Party and also the PFLP, came out in a joint statement condemning and saying this is not right because we are supposed to discuss this together. You know, what kind of government will for a national unity government. And just weeks before, all the factions were meeting in Moscow. And apparently they agreed in Moscow to form a national unity government. And then Abbas comes out with this new government, out of the blue. So it's clear that the PA is on one side having talks, internal talks with other Palestinian factions, just to keep, the appearance of we're doing this, we're trying to organize, the internal Palestinian affairs together in a national unity fashion. But on the other hand, they're working with the United States on basically really organizing the day after through, people that they would choose. And that, of course, that would be in line with the requirements of Israel, which makes this claim by Hamas completely expected and completely possible. And it just says a lot about how things are internally in the Palestinian politics.
We have to leave it there. You've been listening to a podcast produced by the Mondo Weiss News Service. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live
every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.